Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Trial and Errors, one of the reporters who first broke the Donald Trump hush money story, describes the surreal experience of watching the former president's trial unfold and tells us about the questions he still wants answered.
Deporting from tradition, the UK passes a controversial law that will see asylum seekers flown to Rwanda. One British politician says that puts refugee claimants and the country's reputation at risk.
A breath of trash air, an activist says the latest fire spewing toxic smoke from a New Delhi landfill is no surprise, but is further proof it's time to do something about one of the world's biggest mountains of garbage.
Experimenting with drugs. A city councillor in Richmond, BC, calls on the province to end a groundbreaking pilot project to decriminalize hard drugs, saying what she is seeing now doesn't look like harm reduction to her.
It took a very long time to get to the points, centuries after James Cook took them from their ancestors, members of an Indigenous nation in Australia. We'll now be able to bring those four traditional spears home.
And the biter end. Doctors in Australia hope to put a stop to an unfortunate trend by issuing some helpful advice. If you've been bitten by a snake, please do not bring it with you to the hospital. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, Radio That Figures, with friends like those, who needs venomies? Today was day two of testimony in Donald Trump's hush money trial, and media outlets are providing up-to-the-minute coverage of what's going on through updates on witnesses and the temperature in the courtroom and whether Mr. Trump is awake. But the story of how the secret payments at the center of this trial became public goes back about 6 years to when two Wall Street Journal reporters first broke it. Joe Palazzo and Michael Rothfeld uncovered secret payments made by Donald Trump's then-lawyer, Michael Cohen, to two women, and links between Mr. Trump and the National Enquirer, which sought to bury certain stories during his campaign for president. They earned a Pulitzer for their reporting, which they expanded in the book The Fixers. Michael Rothfeld is now with the New York Times. We reached him in Livingston, New Jersey.
Michael, this is the first time this week that we're hearing from former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. The first time he's speaking publicly about any of this. You know a lot about this. You wrote the book, of course. What is striking you most about what you've heard from him so far?
Well, it struck me to just hear my colleagues who were there describing how, you know, the words actually came out of his mouth, talking about his private interactions with Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign that led to all of this, to lead to the first prosecution of Donald Trump, and to have him do that while Trump is just sitting there, and these guys who were friends for decades and associates and Pecker on the stand, and saying how he was summoned by Michael Cohen to Donald Trump's office in August of 2015, and Trump asking him, how can you help my campaign? And then them arranging this what prosecutors call the conspiracy to help Trump and hurt his rivals and suppress negative news about him, including the alleged affairs with Karen McDougal and the sexual encounter that Stormy Daniels said that they had.
And how would you assess at this point how damaging you think, at least from where you sit, this testimony from David Pecker is for Donald Trump, at least at this stage?
I think it's very damaging because Pecker, from how he was described, was very calm and very straightforward and very articulate, and was a very accomplished and successful magazine publisher for many years. And he was, you know, describing direct interactions with the defendant, Trump, and that he was personally privy to. So, and this establishes the context and the motivation for what prosecutors are saying is the falsification of business records at the Trump Organization to cover up the repayment of the Stormy Daniels hush money. So the context is that these records were falsified to essentially cover up this campaign finance violation. And so Pecker established, okay, here was the scheme to suppress all this dirt on Trump, and he did it in secrecy.
How do you feel watching this trial, just personally, given how much work you've put into it, into your book?
It's really surreal. I mean, I spent several years reporting on this, and there were so many ins and outs. The federal prosecutors who prosecuted Michael Cohen after the FBI raided him, and then him turning on Trump, and all of these things that happened. And, we always wondered if Trump might be prosecuted first by the federal government and by the Justice Department, and then that didn't happen. And then, you know, the Manhattan DA's office picked this up. So, I mean, we're talking now, from the time I first started working on this, 8 years, until now, to see Donald Trump sitting in court as he runs for re-election. I mean, it's pretty mind-blowing.
It's not surprising that the defense is focusing on Michael Cohen's character, how reliable he might be. That was in their opening statements, we know. But how do you assess that? How do you think that will come across, the fact that Cohen has lied in court, in terms of whether he will be a liability ultimately for the prosecution?
That's a definite vulnerability for the prosecutors, and probably the biggest one they have, because he has pleaded guilty not only to campaign finance crimes related to this, but also to crimes in his personal business, his taxi medallion business, and tax, essentially not paying taxes on some of his income. And he lied to Congress about a Trump project. So, and he's lied in plenty of other contexts. And he's trying to make money off of, you know, through podcasts, and he wrote books. So there's a lot of ammunition. But he's also sort of a very seasoned character in terms of speaking to the media and speaking in public, and he's going to be expecting all this. So I anticipate he will be prepared. It really depends on how well he handles it and how the jury perceives it. Will they, you know, will they think the defense is being too aggressive? And then finally, there's what prosecutors have said, which is you don't have to believe Michael Cohen, because we're going to corroborate testimony with records, with emails, with business documents, all sorts of things, so that as he tells the story, we're going to show you how you can tell that he's telling the truth.
You know so many of the ins and outs, all of the details, but I wonder what questions you still want answered or hope to have answered as this trial proceeds.
I'm very curious to see how Donald Trump's personal involvement is detailed by the witnesses and maybe in any of the records. David Pecker has already started to talk about personal conversations with Trump about the Karen McDougal payment, and Michael Cohen, I anticipate, is going to talk about him and Trump talking about Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. So I'm eager to hear just the narrative about those interactions and how convincing that they are.
Michael, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Rothfeld is a reporter with the New York Times and the co-author of the book The Fixers. We reached him in Livingston, New Jersey. It's not just a garbage dump, it is a veritable mountain of trash. And since Sunday, New Delhi's Ghazipur landfill has been on fire. Unfortunately, fires are not uncommon at one of the largest landfills in the world, but this one was particularly bad, and the smoke blanketed parts of the city in a thick, potentially toxic haze. As of this evening, officials say they've gotten the blaze under control, but locals know it's only a matter of time before the trash heap ignites again. Vimalendu Jha is a local environmental activist. We reached him in New Delhi.
Vimalendu, I think most of our listeners have an image in their mind's eye of what a landfill looks like, but the Ghazapur landfill is very different than most. Can you describe it for us?
It's the largest landfills that India has. It's been around since 1984, so it's almost been like four decades. Of course, it passed its expiry date because it was supposed to be shut down. And in terms of the height of the landfill, it's almost 213 meters taller than Taj Mahal, which is a great monument that we all know. And it actually stores almost 8.5 million tons of garbage. So it is one of the biggest mountain of garbage that we actually have in the country, or perhaps in the world in that sense.
I know you said that there's always a little bit of fire at Ghazipur, the smaller blazes always burning. But this, again, was very, very different over the weekend. How significant was this fire at its peak?
Like, you know, of course, Ghazipur and most of the landfills have been on fire constantly. And we only attend to landfill fires when there are fire tenders that are called. The one that actually happened this weekend has been another extreme instance of fire at Ghazipur landfill. It's almost been 48 hours and still the fire is brimming there. Of course, the government authorities are saying that the fire is under control. But the fact that it was up in flames for more than 36 hours and the ambient air quality all around, people have been troubled. There's a thick haze around the area. That's quite telling that it was yet another incidence of absolute fire and negligence by the government authorities.
What does it smell and look like if you're nearby?
Imagine when your entire city's garbage is on fire, and it is not just organic waste, it's organic and inorganic waste. It's terrible. It's pathetic. And more than the smell and the disgust that you feel, it's the hazard, is the public health damage and the individual health damage that it actually brings in. So it's been extremely, extremely terrible. At least in the immediate periphery, at least 5 to 10 kilometer periphery of the landfill, the situation is really terrible. People have reported that they're not going to school. They're facing difficulties breathing. Imagine 8.5 million tons of garbage that's been lit up.
Any idea what caused this particular fire?
You know, usually, of course, people think that, the government actually is very capable of blaming someone else as if it's a notorious act or of mischief. But the fact that there is, it's a ball, it's a mountain of methane. And the fact that it really brings in 3,000 tons of garbage from different parts of the city to one location, we don't really know what kind of garbage is coming there. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to attribute fire in a landfill of this mm-hmm. scale. So, you know, it could be mischief, but it could just be the fact that it's methane ball rolling up in the city of New Delhi.
We've been speaking, and we'll continue to, of course, about the elections in India. Does this even register on the list of things that many voters, enough voters, are concerned about? Is it becoming an election issue?
Unfortunately, environmental issues, be it of air quality, be it of waste management, be it of this particular instance of landfill fire, it doesn't catch the public imagination, or public is unfortunately not able to connect these issues with direct representatives of power in that sense. But this time we've actually seen in last 48 hours, political parties, quarreling over responsibility, which is a good thing, that because actually responsibility needs to be fixed. But is it actually genuine political fixing and responsibility fixing? We don't really know.
It's quite literally a huge issue, this landfill in particular, but a broader, speaking more broadly as well in your country. So what can you even suggest today that needs to be done that could help get this issue under control?
I think a lack of political will is the biggest problem that India is facing right now. Issues like these could be solved, but there needs to be political will. And by the way, we are only talking about one landfill. We're talking about the capital landfill of India. Issues like these, because it also has an impact on overall ambient air quality. And we all know New Delhi is one of the most polluted cities of the world, one of the most polluted capitals of the world. And therefore, instances like these should ideally get the government in action in that sense. It is really unfortunate that this has happened, and the fact that this has happened several times, several dozen times a year, is when our landfill, this particular one for sure, has been on fire. Ideally, there should be some strict action, and the courts have also taken cognizance of this. Let's see what really happens. But, you know, given the track record of our government institutions and response of our governance, very little, very late is what the ideal response has been. This time, because it's the election season, maybe there's something that comes out of this in that sense.
What would you want people in India who are very much feeling the impact, as you've said, very acutely, the health impacts, what would you want them to do differently?
You know, it's not on the people. Citizens can't fix a landfill. Citizens can't clean a city's air. Citizens can't clean a city's river. So squarely, the responsibility of this is of the government and of the governance model. Therefore, I think it's very, very important for the citizens of our country to ask for more responsive and more responsible government. And I think it's high time that people realize that, you know, at the end of the day, the government that they elect is not just for great flyovers and great buildings and great malls and great industries, but to really ensure that the children breathe cleaner air and they have better longevity and many other public health well-being is what we're talking about. I think citizens need to wake up and demand clean air, demand better governance system when it comes to better water management, better waste management, or better air management.
Vimalendu, thank you.
Yes.
We reached environmental activist Vimalendu Jha in New Delhi, India. Today, Ray Ingray helped his community get some of its stuff back, stuff that was taken 2.5 centuries ago. Mr. Ingray is the director of the leading cultural organization of the La Perouse Aboriginal community, which is located on the shores of Botany Bay, Australia. But today, he and other members of the Gwigal clan of the Dharawal people were at Cambridge University in the UK. They were there for the official return of 4 fishing spears that were hauled off by British explorer Captain James Cook when he arrived in Australia in the Endeavour more than 250 years ago. We reached Ray Ingray in Cambridge.
Ray, how would you put today into words?
Very hard to explain. Mm-hmm. We have mixed emotions. We're super excited to have the 4 remaining spears that were taken by the crew of the Endeavour in 1770 at Botany Bay to be returned. But also it's mixed because there's a bit of reflection and sadness. And because this has been a long campaign, the elders in my community that instigated this are no longer with us. It's a mixed emotions, but overall excited to be having the spears returned to their homelands.
You were not there alone today. In particular, there were 2 young men with deep connections. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, so the families belonging to the La Perouse Aboriginal community in Botany Bay all have long and ancient connections to that area. So many of the descendants living today, their old people would have seen the Endeavour sailing up the coast and into Botany Bay. The 2 young fellas in particular that came with us were descendants from one of the men that challenged the landing of Cook back in 1770. And one in particular's grandfather was the elder who instigated the formal request over 20 years ago to have the spears returned. So it was good that the young ones were there with us today, because eventually they're going to be the ones that are leaders in our community. And, you know, I think the experience they've had will stay with them for a very long time.
David Johnson, who's 24 years old, and Caden Williams-Riley, who's 21, are the 2 young men we were just speaking about there. What did they say to you after, you know, today's event?
Yeah, because I'm related to both of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all agreed that it was a surreal moment because of our families have been campaigning for this. And also the fact that the family group, the clan group, which is the Gwegal clan, you know, are still active in our community making spears the old way. So they were able to look at the spears up close today, knowing that we would have ownership and also support that, you know, our culture in Botany Bay still continues, and cultural practices like making and using those fishing spears still remain in the La Perouse Aboriginal community today.
And I've seen photographs of these spears used for fishing, as you've described there. But can you describe what they look like?
Yeah, the spears, I suppose the obvious look of the spears is that they've been shortened due to the carrying of the spears on the HM Bark Endeavour. And so they're half the size. You know, they're made of a series of prongs and they vary in number due to the more prongs you have, it's usually the more novice you are. And as you get a bit more expert in throwing the spear and catching fish and small games, the number of prongs reduce. And on the tips of those spears are kangaroo sinew glues that bind a small like kangaroo bones or stingray barbs that were attached to the tips of the spears to help in the process of catching the fish. Those prongs are then bounded to the main shaft using rope being made and glues and also kangaroo sinew.
Nicholas Thomas is quoted by the BBC on this story. He's the director of the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology and is a Trinity Fellow, and described the significance of these spears as, quote, as by saying, quote, they reflect the beginnings of a history of misunderstanding and conflict, end quote.
Correct.
When you hear that quote, illustrate what it means for our listeners.
There's no doubt that the contact that occurred between the crew of the Endeavour and the Gwegal people of the Dharawal Nation back in 1770 was not a good engagement. There was conflict, there was theft, and because the spears and other items were taken without permission, we know that it wasn't properly traded. So we know that it wasn't a good encounter. However, our communities also come to the terms that if they weren't taken and cared for all this time, we wouldn't be looking at them today. They're made of natural resources, so over their life, they're supposed to crumble and go back into the earth. And so if they weren't looked after by Trinity College, we wouldn't be seeing them today.
What was said? What changed to make this moment a reality after all of these years?
Yeah, we built up our community built up a good relationship with cultural institutions in Australia. And it wasn't just about us receiving cultural materials that were taken from our part of Australia. It was about how we could build the capabilities of our community members to be able to become curators, be able to become the experts in handling and storing these materials and showcasing these materials. And so it's beyond that transactional engagement. It's actually about true relationship building. So that was one thing that ticked the box for Trinity College. The other one, that there was a clear place or clear understanding of where they would be housed moving forward, and that will be in a museum grade facility so that they can be seen by everyone for another 254 years. Plus, I think the turning point is that over the last decade, we've built a strong relationship with the said cultural institutions in Australia, but also to Trinity College and the Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology that allowed us to have that open conversation around ownership.
Ray, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Ray Ingray is the director of the Gujaga Foundation. We reached him in Cambridge in the UK. You You can hear it on the wind. Seagull impression season is upon us. And to seagull impression fans, the arrival of spring means, of course, that it's time for the annual European Gull Screeching Championship, where people gather in a pub in Belgium and mimic seagulls. We first talked about that squawk off on this program 5 years ago, when the organizer told us it was a fantastic way to celebrate the underrated bird and to have a few pints. Then last year we spoke with a Canadian who was a special guest at the screech off. Kai Sullivan was a good enough sport to let his Belgian friends convince him to take part and to play along when his mother, a regular listener, wrote in and gently but firmly ordered us to put him on the air. He was great. Still, a lot of you thought you could do better than Kai Sullivan, and you let us hear it.
This is Moshe calling from Edmonton, and I'm calling with my seagull impression.
Hi, I'm Jackson Barr calling from London, Ontario, and I think I have one good seagull sound in me.
Hi, it's Jason Turgeon, Thunder Bay, Ontario. I'm going to try and do a seagull call, but I don't think I'm very good. Anyways, take care. Bye.
Hi there, this is Marcus. Some of my favorite sounds, in fact, walking along the ocean. And they sound something like this. But my favorite is when they're kind of dabbling around, just walking over the rocks. If you're sitting on a log by a fire, snacking on something, they've just turned over a clam. The content sound is something like this.
Hi, this is Barbara Kidney from Shongum, New York, taking you up on your request for gull impressions. This is a glaucous wing gull, more or less. Hope you enjoyed that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We did enjoy that.
Absolutely.
Well, this year there's a pretty stellar new champion, a 9-year-old wunderkind from the UK named Cooper Wallace, a prodigy, the young Mozart of seagull mimicry.
3, 2, 1. A seagull that is hungry.
Yes.
Right. The jury, 17, 19, 18, and 19.
Absolutely breathtaking. From the BBC, 9-year-old European gull screeching juvenile champ Cooper Wallace. So, as it happens, listeners, do you think you can beat that? Do you have the chops to show up a child? Let's hear your best / worst screech. Call TalkBack at 416-205-5687. That number again, 416-205-5687.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
As many as are of that opinion say aye.
Aye.
Of the contrary, no.
The sound last night as the British Parliament passed legislation paving the way to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. As we've told you on the show before, the bill requires officials and courts to regard Rwanda as a safe country for refugee claimants, no matter the circumstances on the ground. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak says flights will begin in as little as 10 weeks in an effort to fulfill his promise to stop the boats. Meanwhile, French officials say five migrants, including a 7-year-old girl, died trying to cross the English Channel on an overloaded boat. Andrew Harding is with the BBC and witnessed the boat leaving shore.
There were just far too many people trying to squeeze inside this little inflatable dinghy. And you could see people standing in the middle. And what we've since learned is that we were watching people almost certainly being crushed underfoot, perhaps suffocated, trampled to death. It felt like just a melee as people try and fight for a spot on the life raft, on the inflatable.
The BBC's Andrew Harding speaking today. David Anderson is a barrister and an independent member of the House of Lords who opposed that law. We reached him in London.
Lord Anderson, given where you stand on this bill, do you think it's actually going to make a difference that fewer migrants will try to make these dangerous, even deadly crossings if they know they might be sent to Rwanda?
It's a horrible trade, this trafficking in human beings. And it was a terrible event today. Unfortunately, not unusual. We've had deaths among people trying to cross the channel in small boats in every one of the last 9 or 10 months. And what it really demonstrates to me is two things. Why we have to do what we can to stop this trade in human beings across the channel, but also how hard it is going to be to do it. I mean, what really struck me about this story was that after 100 or more people tried to clamber on that boat, and five of them had died, either being drowned or being trampled, no fewer than 57 got back in the boat and completed their journey across the channel to the UK. But you have to reflect that if people are not deterred from crossing the channel by the fact that they've just seen five people die on that boat in front of their own faces, it's a little hard to imagine that the prospect in the future, possibly, of being among those sent to Rwanda is really going to be the factor that stops them coming.
British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, as you likely know, has called this an innovative approach. He says it will be a, quote, game changer, this policy. You build this bill quite differently.
Well, it's true. It's a novel approach, and it's doing something that very few Western countries have done before, which is to say you may no longer claim asylum in the United Kingdom. If you arrive on our shores by irregular means, then you are going to be sent to Rwanda, not only to have your claim processed, but also to be resettled if your claim is successful. Now, there are a number of difficulties with that. Some of them are quite practical. It's incredibly expensive. By the time we've sent the first 200 or 300 people to Rwanda, the bill to the Rwandan government is going to be already approaching £500 million. And then you've got problems of capacity. No one seems to think you can send more than maybe 2,000 of these people to Rwanda in a year. Well, we're getting 100 people a day at the moment crossing the channel in small boats, and we've already got a backlog of something like 50,000 people who've already arrived, have already been told that they're not eligible to claim asylum in the UK. And the idea that all these people can be sent to this tiny country in Central Africa and accommodated there to acceptable standards is, I'm afraid, for the birds. So the whole exercise depends on deterrence.
The label you put on this bill is, quote, a legal fiction.
I'm afraid that's right. I described it also as a post-truth bill. And the bill goes to huge lengths to try and cut out the courts and to cut out appeal to international law or what you would call charter rights, you know, we call human rights. So the way they do this is they asked us in Parliament to declare that Rwanda is safe and always will be safe. And courts, government ministers, immigration officials are actually banned from considering evidence to the contrary. This is said to be conclusive. And it seems to me, I'm afraid, a classic example of trying to say that something is true and make it true. Well, you don't make something true by saying it is so.
One of the people saying that it is safe is the UK's Deputy Foreign Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, who says he has, quote, no doubts about the safety of Rwanda. And if you look at the statistics, Kigali is arguably safer than London, end quote. The UK's Supreme Court has said something very different as well. But what is the evidence you have when people present you with that argument?
Yeah, I would be perfectly happy for the minister, the deputy foreign minister or the foreign minister, to make the decision that Rwanda is safe. That's what happens with lots of other countries. There is a ministerial decision that a country is safe. That can be challenged in the courts. And if the court disagrees, then it will say so. And that is, in fact, exactly what our Supreme Court did a few months ago. They said, well, Rwanda isn't safe. That I have no problem with. But what the government is trying to do is to put all this outside the reach of the courts by saying it's Parliament's judgment that Rwanda is safe, and in no circumstances must that judgment be challenged. I think that's contrary to the rule of law, and I think it makes a mockery of the situation. For example, if things were to go backwards in Rwanda, very much hope they don't, then our law would still declare it to be safe, and there is nothing that any decision maker could say to the contrary. What I was trying to do as the bill went through was to build some flexibility into it, give the minister a power to say, you know what, it's not safe anymore, or give the courts a power to say the minister says it's safe, but we don't agree. Mm-hmm. And that's not something the government in the end was prepared to accept.
Yeah, your amendment introducing those kinds of safeguards, that proposed amendment to ensure
that I persuaded the House of Lords, which is a bit like your Senate, but I couldn't persuade the House of Commons.
You mentioned how serious a problem there is, how deadly a problem it is, and you see that on a regular basis. What would you suggest as an alternative that could help?
I don't think there are any answers, but we have had this problem before. The reason they're now coming in small boats is because there is no other way they can get over. And 20 years ago, we were seeing a lot of irregular arrivals, people hanging onto the trains, and that was fixed, because our ministers and the French ministers got together and they took the necessary measures, built the infrastructure and so on. So it is possible to do it. And I think the ultimate solution has got to be cracking down on the organized gangs that are actually bringing these people across and incidentally exploiting them terribly, taking huge sums of money from families that can't really afford it to try and get a family member into England. You know, this is something that all advanced societies are going to be facing for a long time. And what governments and policymakers have to do is try and find a way of keeping a cap on it so that you don't get to the stage where the population turns to the extremes.
Lord Anderson, thank you for your time.
Not at all.
David Anderson is a barrister and a member of Britain's House of Lords. We reached him in London. Game winner from Canadian Jamal Murray, who earlier in that game had struggled, hitting only three shots in the first three quarters. But it helps to have your teammates believe in you.
It's just funny, man, because, you miss four or five in a row, you miss six, seven in a row. Everybody's telling you keep shooting. You're not missing, you're missing bad on some of them. And then you miss 10, 11 in a row, 12 in a row. And then it's like, man, should I change something? Should I look at something else? But, man, my teammates just told me, keep shooting, keep being aggressive. Yoke told me I made a couple, he kept coming back to me. So I just, like I said, if it wasn't for my teammates, I might not even get to that shot. So I did what I could today. I tried to pick it up on defense. I knew I wasn't making no shots. So like I said, it was just a great team win. We all stuck together. They came out hot and firing. And like I said, it was a great effort.
That shot put the Denver Nuggets up 2-0 in the best of seven series against the LA Lakers. The next game of that series is on Thursday. It's a daring three-year pilot project to decriminalize hard drugs in BC. But just over a year in, a growing chorus of politicians say the experiment has failed. The program allows adult drug users to carry up to 2.5 grams of opioids, cocaine, methamphetamine, and ecstasy for personal use without facing charges, and allows open drug use in some public spaces. BC Premier David Eby says he shares some of his critics' concerns about the initiative, but harm reduction advocates are defending the program, saying that some changes need to be made, but overall, it's doing a lot of good. Alexa Liu is a city councillor in Richmond, BC. That's where we reached her.
Councillor Liu, what are you seeing in Richmond that makes you feel this project needs to go?
What we're seeing in Richmond is we're seeing more and more homeless people. We've been seeing encampments. We've been seeing people in their zombie stance who are high on drugs. We're seeing people in stairwells. We're hearing from businesses who are having to administer naloxone. Some have been able to do it successfully and some unsuccessfully. So they've had people dying in their arms in their places of business where people are coming and doing drugs in parkades and stairwells and out front of their businesses. And we're just seeing general level of civil disobedience, a lot of theft in the stores. So we're seeing a lot of impacts from this.
Deputy Vancouver Police Chief Fiona Wilson testified last week that this pilot program means her officers are now limited in what they can do, how they can respond to drug use calls at places like bus stops and hospitals, for example. Is that what you're hearing from police officers there as well?
Yes. Our officers are saying that even if they catch someone with drugs, if the person says it's for their own personal use, they have to send that person on their way and hand them a pamphlet that says, here's how to maybe not die from the drugs that you're holding. It also doesn't prevent the person from selling them to somebody else, like one of our kids in town. So the person may or may not be using it for their own purposes. And if they are, there's still no guarantee that it's a safe supply once the officer's interacted with them. And so imagine the person, you then come back half an hour later and now the person's being on an overdose call. So there's a lot of helplessness amongst our officers that's going on as well.
There were concerns and helplessness before this pilot project, as you likely know well, Councillor, and the concern was at that time, and still is for many people, that putting people in jail, arresting them after that interaction, wasn't a solution either. So what would be the solution in your view? Is scrapping this project really going to solve the problem?
Scrapping this project isn't necessarily going to close any of the existing consumption sites or anything else. What it will do is if you give people an option to either get treatment or face a fine or face some other consequence for their behaviors, then it also becomes incumbent upon the province to provide that treatment so that they can make that choice. So what we really need is more treatment and more recovery options for people. And it has to be there for people. It can't be that the person has to phone in every day at the same time to try and see if that bed's available and do their own detox to try and make themselves available so they can go into recovery. We need better supports for people. It's not good enough what we're doing. And turning them back out on the streets, hoping that they'll still survive the toxic drug supply, that's not a humane response either.
Last year on the program, we spoke to New Westminster Councillor Nadine Nakagawa. She says the decriminalization has become the scapegoat for growing homelessness and mental illness that has nothing at the root of it to do with drug use, she said. How would you respond to that idea?
We have a homeless population that includes people who have addiction. So there are homeless people and they don't want to use some of the shelters because there are drug addicted people. So they go to slightly different places. Some of the churches are feeding them. That's an issue as well. So we have a homeless problem and we have a homeless problem with people with addictions and a mental health problem. So we in Richmond we implemented the Fox 80 program where we have a psychiatric nurse and an RCMP officer travel together so that a person who is having a mental health crisis can get more appropriate care, treatment. So it's not just a police arriving, but it's also a police arriving to control the situation. We've also implemented that as we have the Yankee 30 program for youth. So we started that pilot program. It's now being shared amongst the province. So we're really proactive here in Richmond, trying to do the best we can for people with mental health issues and who then also have, the multi issues, including addictions. And we're doing the best we can. But opening it up and just having a free-for-all, everyone can do drugs, you can carry your drugs wherever you want, you have a right to stand in anybody's doorway and do drugs and harass your neighbors, isn't working.
That wasn't the intention. Then that's not what the pilot project said, though, in fairness, right?
No, but that's been the result of it. So we have to dial it back. We have to realize that it's not working. Keeping it going the way it was supposed to work isn't working. So we have to do something different. Stop. figure it out, make some changes, and move forward.
I've had this conversations like this, you know, over the last few years with folks embedded and dealing with these issues from different angles. And I asked them all, where do you think we're going to be in a year? You know, I grew up in the Vancouver area. It was a problem then, and it's only growing. So what is missing that this can't be resolved and that people can't be safer?
I think what's missing is us being a slave to our compassion. So we have to continue being compassionate with people and hold each other accountable. We have to hold each other accountable for our behaviors, and then we also have to hold the government accountable to have those off-ramps, to have the treatment and recovery spaces available for people. We have to think that it matters to help people and that we have those spaces available for them.
I think people might hear the first part of what you said there, and I'm hearing your whole answer. I hear what you're saying. People might hear the first part of that answer, being a slave to compassion, and stop there because it's quite arresting to hear that.
It breaks people's hearts to see people bent over in half mm-hmm. in the zombie pose. You know that they're suffering, that they're not well. And leaving people out on the street in the cold and the rain, like, nobody wants to do that to somebody else. And knowing that they're just being turned back around, oh, fine, you had an overdose. Okay, well, best of luck. Carry on with your life. It's like, no, we just saved you. We want to help you. We're not helping you by putting you back on the street with the same drugs, with no accountability either for you or for us.
Councillor Liu, we will leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alexa Liu is a city councillor in Richmond, BC. If you're talking to your neighbor while he's barbecuing and he gestures and accidentally stabs you with a kebab, do not take your neighbor with you to the hospital and tell the doctor, "This is the person who stabbed me with the kebab." It's not helpful. The doctor will not say, oh, sure, this is Alan. We know what dry rub he uses, so we know we'll have to do a peppercornectomy. She won't recognize him. His presence is distracting and unwelcome. Similarly, doctors in Queensland, Australia, have just issued another what not to do. If you get bitten by a snake, please do not bring it with you to the hospital. It seems like that might go without saying, but no. Earlier this month, a snake bite victim showed up at Bundaberg Hospital in Queensland with a Tupperware container containing an extremely venomous eastern brown snake. Don't bring a poisonous snake to the hospital doesn't feel like the start of a presentation so much as the whole presentation. But Dr. Adam Michael from Bundaberg Hospital did elaborate. First, he says people should not further interact with a snake that has already proven bitey. Second, snakes freak the staff out. Third, they don't need to see the snake to treat you for snake bite. And fourth, quote, "We're actually not trained to identify snakes, and so it's not helpful," unquote. Yes, human health specialists are not snake experts. They don't recognize particular breeds any more than they would recognize your clumsy neighbor, Alan. So please, Australians, just leave it where it bit you. And if you insist, just go back and visit it later. For old times' sake. According to Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, the government's new budget will ensure that the wealthiest Canadians pay their fair share. But the group that represents the country's doctors says physicians and ultimately patients may end up paying the price. The proposed changes include increasing the taxing of capital gains, that is, the income generated from the sales of assets. If implemented, 2/3 of a corporation's capital gains would be taxed, rather than the current 50%. But the Canadian Medical Association says doctors' retirement savings will take a hit, and they're worried the changes could drive more physicians out of the profession. Dr. Joss Reimer is the association's president-elect. We reached her in Winnipeg.
Dr. Reimer, we've heard the government say that this budget and what's in it is all about fairness. So if doctors make more money, why shouldn't they pay higher capital gains taxes?
Well, one of the things we want to be clear about is what we're really worried about is the capital gains tax changes on corporations. A lot of Canadians may not realize, but most physicians, especially family physicians, are incorporated. Most of us are not eligible for pensions or other types of retirement savings, and so we use corporate income as a way to save for retirement. And that's where we're really worried about how these taxes are going to change things.
The incorporated practice model that you talked about allows for doctors to be taxed at a much lower small business corporate rate than if they were just declaring this as their own personal income. So I hear what you're saying on one hand, you know, that they don't have pensions like other people working at companies might, but other listeners hearing what you're saying might also hear, well, doctors are already getting a bargain. Why should they get a break here?
Well, another thing to talk about is that we actually do pay income tax. Even with the corporation set up, it just gets deferred to later on. So as soon as a physician takes money out of their corporation, they're paying both capital gains and income tax on that income. So while we do get to take advantage of the corporate tax rate temporarily, we're not getting a tax-free approach to the income. And so what we're worried about here is all of these physicians who have worked so long, especially family physicians, setting up what is their retirement savings, are suddenly surprised that they're going to have a lot less retirement than they thought that they would have available. And we're not worried so much about income overall, but when we have so much problem with access to healthcare, particularly primary care, anything that's discouraging people from going into family medicine is something that makes us really worried.
A spokesperson for Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland, speaking generally in a statement reported on by Canadian Press, says the federal government is changing the capital gains inclusion rate, quote, because it's unfair that a nurse pays a higher marginal tax rate than a multimillionaire, end quote. So I hear what you're saying about what doctors need to do to save for retirement. But there's a whole swath of people who will say they're making a lot more money than many of us will ever see. They are still getting a lower rate than I would be.
Well, there's no question that there's many people who are struggling with a high cost of living. And, you know, we see the impacts on their health when we see them struggling to pay for groceries, to pay for housing, other necessities. So we're not saying we want physicians to have an exception to the personal capital gains tax, where, you know, we think physicians, just like every other Canadian, should be paying taxes. We value the public health system. We get paid by the public health system. But what we do also worry about is when we hear Canadians talk about how they're struggling to access health care. And so anything that's going to be a roadblock to retaining and recruiting physicians, that makes me really worried about whether or not Canadians are going to have access to primary care when they need it.
Will the fact that the government is planning to increase the lifetime capital gains exemption on the sale of a small business shares from $1 million to $1.25 million, will that help assuage some of the concerns that your members have?
Yeah, I don't want, without delving too deep into the small business tax exemptions, for the most part, physicians aren't eligible for that. So it has to do with the fact that it's retirement savings as opposed to active income coming in and out of a business. And so we'll be paying the capital gains as well as income tax on all of the money that we pull out in retirement.
What are you hearing from doctors since the budget dropped?
Well, I'm hearing a lot of worry. Now, I'm also hearing physicians who feel like it's really important that we all pay taxes and that we make sure that we're providing for a system that's going to support our patients. Physicians went into their specialty because they care about Canadians, they care about health. And so they want to make sure that our systems are strong. But I'm also hearing the burnout rates are increasing and that the physicians are really stressed about, you know, do I have to keep working longer? Do I have to switch to a different specialty? Like, what do I do to make sure that I can retire and support my family?
But many of those underlying concerns predate this budget, right?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, when we see physicians struggling, they're talking to us about administrative burdens, all the paperwork that they're spending, you know, a day a week doing. And so the capital gains is just one issue amongst many that we want to work on. We've had great interactions with this government trying to come up with solutions and make positive improvements to the healthcare system. So I have no doubt that any decisions they made in this circumstance were not to impact physicians more than anyone else.
Do you think that there's, it seems, Dr. Reimer, that you think that there might be a disconnect between how lucrative, you know, Canadians who aren't doctors think this field is and the reality? Are you saying that it's not?
There's a lot of family physicians who have to pay a lot out of pocket. So the income that you might see posted for them, that income also has to support, you know, somebody to answer the phones. It has to support the nurse who, you know, takes your blood pressure, has to support the cleaning staff, has to support the rent, the electricity, the water, all of the things that go into running a clinic. You know, unlike hospitals, which are paid by government, family physicians really do subsidize primary care because they pay for all of those supports in running a clinic. And so when we're thinking about how something like capital gains impacts physicians, particularly for family physicians, they're going to feel unsupported and they're going to be struggling to figure out, well, what are the next steps? How do I make sure that I can retire?
When and if you get a meeting with government officials, are you going to advocate for an exemption specifically for family physicians? Because there may be other physicians who have a much more lucrative practice. Right. So is your focus family physicians? Do you want an exemption solely for them?
We really need to drill down in the details with all of the different impacts. So, you know, this is new. The budget proposal has just come out and we don't have all the details yet about how exactly we could tweak things. And so we want to have those conversations. You know, I worry the most about family medicine, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other areas of medicine that are also going to be impacted in a way that's problematic. So we need to have those conversations with our members and with government to try to identify, you know, where we're going to have the unintended consequences that are going to hurt Canadians.
Dr. Reimer, thank you for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Joss Reimer is the president-elect of the Canadian Medical Association and currently the chief medical officer of the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. We reached her in Winnipeg. At one time, Edmonton was home to one of the busiest airports in Canada. During the Second World War, Americans got their planes ready for the harsh Russian weather and sent them off to the front out of Hangar 11 in Edmonton. And now it looks like that historic hangar has been destroyed. Last night, it caught fire. Ryan Lee is the curator of the Alberta Aviation Museum. We reached him in Edmonton.
Ryan, I know you're not too far from the site. What is left of Hangar 11 now?
Basically nothing. I mean, I can see it from my office, and it's, you know, it's still smoldering a little bit, but it's just, you know, you could fit it into a couple of dumpsters. It's pretty far gone.
Still smoldering, though. For you, and given what we've said you do, you're the curator of the Aviation Museum there. What is it like for you personally as someone who loves this field?
It's pretty shocking. I mean, I live very close to the airport as well, or the former airport. So I rushed over last night just to make sure everything was okay on our end. And, yeah, it was pretty gutting watching it burn. I mean, it's a pretty significant part of our city's history as far as aviation goes. So, you know, that really represents about half of the World War II aviation story of Edmonton that just kind of went up in flames in an hour.
I've driven past it once. It's certainly impossible to miss. You hinted at a little bit of its history there. Was there anything inside as well that speaks to that history?
No. So after the war, it was used by a variety of businesses. Mm-hmm. And when the airport closed down in 2013, they had removed the former tenants. So it had been sitting empty since then. Mm-hmm. And it had originally been scheduled for demolition. But a developer stepped in and purchased it and went to the city and said, I'd like you to designate it as a municipal heritage building, and I'd like to redevelop it into kind of a community center and apartment space for students. So that was the plan, and, you know, he'd been wanting to redevelop it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, if we go further back in time, you mentioned it a moment ago, just illustrate for our listeners what was happening at Hangar 11.
So Hangar 11 was built for the United States Army forces. Mm-hmm. And in Edmonton during the war, we had two major Air Force bases here at the airport. The Royal Canadian Air Force base was on our side of the airport. We were training Allied air crews. And on the east side of the airport was the American base. And they were participating in the Lend-Lease program. So the Americans were sending aircraft to the Soviet Union to help them with their war effort. And to get them there, they would fly them to Montana and then up to Edmonton. And Edmonton was the last major airport before you got to Alaska. Mm-hmm. So they'd stop here and do major winterization on the aircraft and inspect them before their final leg of the journey. So they'd fly them up to Alaska, and Soviet pilots would pick them up there and take them to the war front. So we had thousands and thousands of aircraft coming through here during the war, with making Edmonton one of the busiest airports in the world during the Second World War.
How did you feel about the plans to redevelop it? Did you feel that it was going to allow people to get up close to that history again?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, any time you're able to actually continue to use a historical building for, you know, a novel purpose, mm-hmm. is better than, you know, letting it get demolished or, you know, letting it sit abandoned. So it was an opportunity to, you know, continue to tell the story in a unique way. And now, you know, there's very little left at the airport. So the Aviation Museum is also in a World War II hangar. Ours is provincially and municipally designated. And we're really the only thing left that really tells the story of Edmonton's aviation history.
Why do you think it's so important to keep telling that particular facet of Edmonton's history?
I think it's important to really celebrate the city itself and the community and what kind of made Edmonton the community it is today. So all aspects of our history, and aviation played a huge role in the development of our city, like culturally, economically, demographically. So as more and more people, you know, either are born or they move to Edmonton, either from parts of, other parts of Canada or from overseas, they really need that something to connect them to where they're living and really understand what makes this city the way it is. And, you know, that's aviation, it's sports teams, it's our natural resources and, River Valley. There's a lot of things that go into Edmonton and what make Edmonton the, you know, special place it is. And I think it's quite important to keep a lot of those reminders around to make sure people stay connected to that part of our story.
You, as we've said and established, you care a lot about aviation history in particular. Do you think the broader community cares as much as you do about this building and that part of Edmonton's history?
I think yes and no. If you go online, you see a lot of comments that, you know, oh, it's a derelict building and it burned down, who cares? But, you know, it was going to be redeveloped into a pretty important community center. So, you know, there is a big debate with certain historical buildings, like the Rossdale Power Plant, you know, is currently not in use, but it's a designated historic building. So if we're able to find a use for a building that keeps people engaged and keeps people using that building, I think it's important. And from an environmental point of view, you know, a lot of people say, well, these older buildings are quite inefficient. Well, it's much more efficient to maintain a building that's already been built than to knock it down and build a new building. It's way more environmentally impactful that way. So the more that we're able to actually preserve these buildings, I think for the better. And it's, you know, even more important, showing just how quickly things can get lost, that we really focus on what we have left.
You've also said that, you know, it is, of course, a piece of history from the Second World War, Hangar 11, but also a place where people's parents and grandparents worked.
Yeah, I mean, after, you know, the main company that did a lot of the work was called Aircraft Repair, and later Northwest Industries. Lee Brentnell or Francis Winspear, who the Winspear Center is named after, are pretty famous names associated with Northwest Industries. And during the war, they employed a couple thousand people, including about 1,000 women. And, you know, those women were employed in very non-traditional roles at the time, doing sheet metal repair or rewiring aircraft, stuff that certainly they hadn't been trained to do that before that, but they, mm-hmm. they took them in and trained them in doing all of these roles. So, you know, there's a lot of stories that tie into not only that building, but other, you know, aspects of the aviation story here in Edmonton that, you know, even if your family has really no aviation connection, there's probably a grandmother somewhere that, you know, was a sheet metal repair person here at Northwest Industries.
Ryan, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ryan Lee is the curator of the Alberta Aviation Museum. We reached him in Edmonton. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.